Good morning. My name is Greg Frank. I'm a hearings officer, and I am the hearings officer, at least I believe, that will be hearing the cases, and it's plural, which is a bit unusual, but the cases that we're going to have before us. I'm going to give you some numbers, and if you haven't picked up the decision or the staff administrative decision that's sitting up on the table, then you probably should do that, because on those it has the numbers I'm going to give you, because those numbers have a couple important purposes that will come up later in this hearing process. But for the record, today is August 13th, 2018. It's just a little bit after 9 o'clock in the morning at the Portland City Hall Portland Hearing Room, which is room 3000 at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue. And the case numbers that I'm concerned about, and you should be as well, are LU1727-7786CU and LU1727-7796CU. All right, I know that's boring, and who wants to write them down in the whole nine yards, but as we go along, you'll see that those two numbers are kind of important. I'm assuming, but if I assume incorrectly, and that's almost always what an assumption is, but if I assume incorrectly that you don't know which case is which, relates to which property address, ask me and I will do my best to make sure we're on the right case if you're going to deal just with one case. All right, so that's kind of the particulars. Let me get out of the way a couple things that are absolutely necessary from my perspective. I am a hearings officer. I've been hearings officer for the City of Portland full-time for about 16 years and for just on a contract basis for maybe a year and a half, 2 years. I've heard just a couple land use cases during that time. But one of the things that's important to me is that you understand that I have heard land use hearings cases, and that I have had during that tenure some relationship. When I say relationship, I don't mean close, some contact with people that are involved with the cases. First of all, the planner that's sitting to your front left, I have had cases with before. I will tell you that he has been mad at me. Actually, the last case probably was not particularly thrilled with me that I heard. But I'm just telling you that I don't always agree with him, and he would be the first to admit that. Secondly is Mr. Robinson, who is representing, I believe, the applicants in this case. I have had cases with before, other than perhaps, and I'm not even sure of this, but other than perhaps at CLEs or continuing education, I don't think we've had any contact other than the hearing room itself. I do not believe I have a personal relationship that would disqualify me from hearing a case with either of these individuals. Looking in the audience, I don't recognize anybody else, so obviously I can't have too many relationships with you, but I'm going to find that I don't have any conflicts of interest in this case, and I'm going to find that I don't have any bias in this case, and can believe that I do believe that I can hear this case objectively and make a decision. The cases. If this is the only time, and I'm telling you this is the only time I ask for a response from the audience, does anybody in the audience, including staff, have any objections that I hear this case? With that, then, I'm going to hear it. You're stuck with me as the hearings officer. This case, the cases we have today are a little bit unusual only because I have read the staff reports, by the way, or the staff decisions, by the way, from front to back a couple times. So I'm relatively familiar with what's in the document. Now, whether you agree with the document or disagree with the document, I'm familiar with that much of it. And I have not said that I've agreed myself with the document itself or the documents, but I am familiar with those documents. I'm going to treat these cases as so similar as that we hear both cases at the same time, all right? I think from your perspective, you should be jumping up and down and being very thankful that you're not here for one hearing, and then we come back and do this another hearing. So I think I've done you all a favor, but then again, there's always two sides to every coin, and somebody may say, no, that's not the case. But I am going to treat these cases as essentially the same, although I will be drafting two separate decisions in this case, and we do have two separate files. All right, I need you to understand, we have two separate files, two separate decisions. All right, I made the administrative decision this morning that despite what it says on the notice, that if you have something to submit, you put it into one spot. You don't have to make multiple copies. And I apologize, but when we first got these cases, we thought that it would be easier to have everything segregated. When you testify today, and everybody has a right to testify, when you testify, if you're only talking about one of the two properties, let me know that. And I take really good notes, all right? But if I don't take good notes, I go back and listen to the recording, and I will make sure that I know that your comments relate only to one case. So when you come up to testify, if you're only talking about one property, let me know. If you have something to submit, I'm going to put it into both files, and I will make a determination if you're only talking about one property that doesn't relate to the other one. I will make that determination, okay? So that's my task. So that kind of takes care of what I consider the complicating factor of these cases. So when you come up and testify, just tell me what you want to tell me. Here's what's going to happen in the process of the hearing today. All right, and it actually went out on the notice of the hearing, and I used to not follow these very carefully, the process, but I am now actually trying to follow the process that it has on the back here, only because I think it's unfair to people that they've read this document and then I come and change things up on them, and I don't think that's very fair. So here's what we're going to do. The Bureau of Development Services representative is going to be giving the first presentation or the first testimony. He's going to be using the screen to your right. Those of you who are sitting on the door side, difficult angle. I didn't design this room, all right? So if you want to get up and move and see it at a slightly less acute angle, then feel free to get up and move. And when he's finished, you can move back or you can stay where you are or whatever you're going to do. So Bureau of Development Services is going to go first. After that, I'm going to ask the appellant, okay, and if there's a representative of the appellant, I'd ask that person to come up first. If there are two representatives, I'd ask them both to come up. Only one gets to go first, but the way I read the appeal, it's only a Mr. Gardner. Is that it? Yeah. So you would be first, all right? And after your testimony, then I'd ask anybody that supports your position, okay? The Neighborhood Association position. So all those in support of, in essence, opposition to the applicant. And that's putting it a slightly different way, all right? So we've had the Bureau of Development Services, appellant, people who support the appellant's position, and then I'm going to ask for the applicant to come forward, and following the applicant, anybody who supports the applicant's position, all right? In other words, put it slightly different, is opposed to the appeal. I hate the double negatives, but I want to make sure we're clear, all right? And then after that, I'm going to ask for the appellant's rebuttal, and Mr. Gardner, I'm going to ask just with a nod if you have any objections that I give the applicant a right of rebuttal. Do you have any objections to that? All right, so Mr. Robinson, you'll have the ability for a final rebuttal. I failed to include the staff, and so after all the testimony, I will ask staff for any final comments, and then it will go to the appellant, and then it will go to the applicant, all right? That's my error, and I apologize for that, okay? So that's the process. If you haven't seen this document, which is the hearings officer process on appeal, I want to go over a couple things very quickly. By the way, I'm really quiet during the hearings. I just need to get this stuff out so that you understand what you get to do, what you should do, and maybe what you shouldn't do. All right, so if you're here today to testify, and everyone will get at least one opportunity to testify, you'll notice that staff gets an opportunity to speak twice, appellant gets an opportunity to speak twice, their representative, and the applicant's representative will get a chance to speak twice. Those people all get to speak twice. If you're not one of those three people, then use your time and get out what you want to say. Had a hearing a couple weeks ago, not here, but on the other side of the mountain, and I said exactly that. If you don't speak and you're one of the people who get to speak once, you don't get to speak again. And I had a woman that wanted to argue with me after the whole hearing was done, and then after the hearing's closed, I get to testify again. And I said, no, you don't, all right? And if I'm very agreeable most of the time, but I follow that process. So no time limits, no time limits. So if you've got something to say, say it. If you're having sort of a, I call it a senior moment in my particular case, and you go, oh my God, I forgot something, take a break. In other words, take a mental break, a pause, look at your notes, say, just a sec, I gotta look at my notes, and make sure you've covered everything that you wanna say, right? Really important. All right, what should you testify about? A hearings officer in a case like this is limited to making a decision based on the approval criteria. And since there are only a couple people in here that go to land use hearings as a hobby, then I'm going to tell you that most of you don't probably know what the phrase approval criteria means. But let me tell you what you need to testify about. Approval criteria are, in essence, the rules or the laws that apply to this case. I don't get to make decisions based on anything other than the approval criteria that are in effect for this case. So if something's going to happen, doesn't count. If something has been repealed and was once upon a time, doesn't count. If it's something your neighborhood association would like, doesn't count. If it isn't a law or rule, approval criteria at the time that this application is complete, actually application in essence filed, then it doesn't count. All right? I have been on your side, all right, of cases. And I want to say, I just don't like it. It just isn't fair. Fair usually isn't an approval criteria. Don't like it isn't an approval criteria. And so how do you know what are the approval criteria? Well, I'll tell you what the staff believes are the approval criteria are in those decisions over there. That's what staff believes the relevant approval criteria are. So what's your testimony going to be about? It's going to be about those approval criteria, or the staff included too many approval criteria and you should kick some of them out, or didn't include enough. Now, since this is an appeal, technically we're kind of stuck with what Mr. Gardner put in his appeal document. But I tend to be a little bit flexible on that, but not a lot. In other words, surprising Perry Mason style isn't going to work. All right? So I prefer that you stick with the approval criteria in the documents. But if not, have a darn good reason why something should be included or shouldn't be included. All right? So that's what effective testimony is all about. I'm going to tell you that this case is not like some other cases that you may have been involved with or may have heard about. This case is not, if I make a decision, is not appealable to City Council. Okay? So don't rely on politics. Rely on the approval criteria. All right? So it's not appealable to City Council. Where is it appealed to? The Land Use Board of Appeals, which is a land use, in essence, court. And they are going to look to see whether or not my decision is based on substantial evidence and whether or not I interpreted the rules or the laws or the approval criteria correctly. Okay? If you don't bring up an issue today, or in this case, before me, then you lose the right to bring that up as a surprise before LUBA. All right, it's either speak now or forever hold your peace. That's the easiest way to look at it. So there's no keeping back the good stuff. You're going to testify in this hearing, or you're going to submit documents in this hearing that you wish, if you didn't like my decision, to appeal before the Land Use Board of Appeals. All right? My decision in this is a type 2 case, so I'm required to issue my decision within 17 days of the date the record closes. That's the other tricky part about this. Maybe the people who come to land use hearings because they think they're fun know this, but I will tell you that the case may close today. May. But you have a choice. And this is the other part that I'm really ogreish or stickler about. You have the right during your testimony to say, I want the record to remain open. In other words, you don't want it to end today. What does that mean if you say something like that? What it means is that I must keep the record open for not less than 7 days for the submission of new evidence, and following that, an additional rebuttal period of 7 days, all right? Typically, that's the applicant, but we'll talk about that. My point is state law requires me. I have no choice on this. If somebody rings a bell and says, I want the record to remain open, it will remain open. If one person requests the record to remain open, it will remain open. Two people doesn't get 14 days, and we don't start adding days in the whole nine yards. If one person asks, no one else has to ask. I will mark it down, and I will talk about the logistics of how you get information into the record during the open record period. And that's what we call that period after today, that the record remains open. All right, if you can't stay the whole day, what happens? My suggestion is you go and get a card on the way out, and you remember that case number that I gave you, or the case numbers that I gave you? Go to the hearings office website, go to hearing recordings, put in that case number, and listen to the recording. The recording of this hearing, what I'm saying now, what you're going to say in the future, that goes on the public record in the City of Portland record, usually within 2 or 3 days of this hearing. So probably Wednesday or Thursday, you can probably feel comfortable. So that case number that I told you about is really important, because you'll never find the recording without it, ever. Okay. Secondly, what in the heck is the public record in this case? Well, in this case, I have two files, one for each of the addresses, one for each of the appeals. We call them the green files, and the green files contain everything, theoretically, that we have gotten in this case and will get from you. At the end of the hearing, if the hearing closed today, if I was given a gavel and dropped the gavel and it was done today, I will give the staff the opportunity to give the two blue files to my clerk right at the end of the hearing, okay? If I drop the gavel and the hearing closes today, no one else will submit anything else unless the record stays open. That's your job to ask, all right? How do you see this? In other words, is this public record? Of course it's public record. You can see it by going out the door, take a left, go to the very imposing looking window there, ask a clerk, can I see the file or files? Give them the case number. Remember I told you there was a couple reasons why that case number was important? Give the case number, and we will put you in our file viewing room, and you will be able to look at the file. You can mark it as far as putting little things on it, saying this is what I want copied. We will make copies for you. We charge you for the copies, but we make copies for you. If you ask for lots of copies, we may not get it as quick as you want. If you only have a few, we will try to do it right then. It's based on staff. All right. So that's what's in the public record. That's what's in the file. Now you know there's two reasons to have that case number. Number one is listen to recording. If you're not going to stay for the whole hearing, make sure you listen to the hearing to see what, if somebody asks for the record to remain open, and how to get information into the public record during that open period. Okay? If you stick around, I'll tell you. All right? So with that, I think I am done. I'm going to turn it over to the Bureau of Development Services representative. He's going to be using screen to your right. When he's completed, then I'm going to ask the appellant's representative to come on forward. When you do come forward, you're going to give us your first name, last name, spell your last name, give us a mailing address. He has to do that too, all right? Everybody gives us that. Anybody who comes up and testifies and gives us that information will be sent a copy of my decisions, all right? Will be sent a copy of my decision. Often people come here and say, I'm really shy, I don't want to talk, don't make me get in front of a public body or whatever. At the end of the hearing, come up and give the name and address to the clerk, and we'll make sure we send you a copy of the decision as well. Okay? With that then, I'm going to turn it over to the Bureau of Development Services representative. This is his time and place to give his presentation. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Frank. Again, the case number is this is Mark Moffitt, Bureau of Development Services, 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue, Suite 5000-97201. Case number is LU17-277786CU and 18-277796CU. We do have two cases, two identical proposals next door to each other, operated by a husband and wife resident occupant team, and they're both single-party, whole-house, accessory short-term rental units with four bedrooms and eight guests at Budding Home, 7213 and 7223 Southwest Virginia. There's no off-site employees or commercial meetings. House rules proposed with quiet time from 10 to 7. And they're both Type 2 conditional use reviews because that's what is required for all new Type B accessory short-term rental or ASTR facilities. The zoning map is pretty straightforward. It's R5, abutting some multifamily R2 across the street to the east, single-family zone. It has frontage on both Virginia Avenue and then the unimproved right-of-way of Virginia Place, which is west of the site. And the houses were just recently built in the last couple years. The regulations that are critical to this case are in Chapter 207, Accessory Short-Term Rentals of the Zoning Code, and the approval criteria in Chapter 815, Section 105A through E, Institutional and Other Uses in R Zones. On this map, I also showed with the red dashes on the zoning map the residential area that was under consideration in the conditional use area, which is about the notification ring plus, you know, 300 or 400 feet on the farthest points. The site map doesn't really show you much, just a site plan of the existing house. There's nothing really noteworthy on the site plans. This is an aerial photo of the two houses under construction. The site in red is the northern one, 7213. The other house is immediately to the south, 7223. And you can see sort of the transition from single family on Virginia and uphill to the west. It's also pretty much all single family, a couple plexes across the street to the east. But then on the back half of the block across the street to the east, you're into the multifamily. Those are, you know, four-story apartments behind, right up behind Taylor's Ferry at McAdam. And just a frontal view of the homes from Virginia Avenue and their carports, driveways, garages. Another view from the front, contemporary, nice contemporary homes. Another view just further south on the street showing the proximity of the adjacent homes. They are, you know, like three-story homes, so they're a little taller than some of the other ones on the street, but not dramatically out of character. It's another view just up at the corner intersection to the south. That's Miles Place, actually, just showing the context. Hillside homes generally uphill on the west are higher than those downhill on the east. So this is looking up to the west. And just a view down the rest of Virginia Avenue towards Taylor's Ferry. There's an apartment complex on the left. And then I'm a block north at intersection of Nevada and Virginia, just looking uphill to adjacent homes. There is a little section of Virginia Place that's improved, but it's just two lots deep going down from Nevada, so it cuts off. But as you go down that street to the end, you can sort of peek through and see the homes of backside of these two houses for our site. But that's as far as you can get on Virginia Place. We got a lot of neighborhood comments, a lot of concerned neighbors, mostly in opposition. I'll just summarize briefly some of their concerns. Short-term rental guests have lesser interest in community, privacy, and maintaining good relations with neighbors. There's noise impacts, concerns about off-street parking and traffic negatively impacting the area. Size and scale of the houses not in keeping with the area. Having two side-by-side increases impacts. Suggestions of the use aren't uses are primary, not accessory. You need a resident to have them be accessory. That consider it a high-capacity commercial use, just the nature of the ASTRs. They're concerned that it's already in operation. There wasn't people living there already. Concerns about property value and quality of life, housing supply and affordability. The neighborhood wrote an official letter concerned that the overall residential appearance and function, tailoring their comments more to the approval criteria, that the residential appearance and function of the area would be lessened due to the intensity and scale of these side-by-side houses, that noise impacts in particular exceed those of a typical single-family house, and that strangers raise privacy and safety concerns, concerns about on-street parking already being bad and worsening, and that the neighborhood plan seeks to preserve single-family character and reduce through traffic, questioning the ownership of the homes and the residency status of the operators. We did get four letters in support, basically supporting the proposal, saying that the concerns about traffic and parking were exaggerated. I'm not going to go into the staff rebuttal of all these concerns. I was just going to lay out the concerns. I did do a staff response on page 5. In summary, for the staff findings, the critical findings are the criterion A, 1, and 2, overall proportion of household living uses. The proposal can't have a significant negative impact on the overall residential and function and appearance of the area based on the two categories, the number, size, and location of other uses, and then the intensity and scale of uses. It's hard to sort of separate those out in your head. But the first one is looking at how many other non-residential uses are there in the area, and is this one going to really sort of tip the balance over into non-residential? And then that's one. And then the second one is really, what is the intensity and scale of this compared to the surrounding housing and single-family uses? And is this project in its own, the intensity and scale of that, causing issues? And if so, what can you do, conditions, or do you deny it, et cetera? So I think the neighbors' concerns are really mostly about A2, but also A1, in that they're saying there's other ones in the area. So staff found for these only one other legal short-term rental in the residential area, that there was documentation that they live there in the file. We don't have the ability to pick and ask questions beyond the point where someone shows us a driver's license that says they live there. We did, under criterion A1, they were proposing 4 bedrooms with, and we reduced it to 3 with 2 per bedroom, so that means 3 bedrooms with 6 guests. Because there are 2 side-by-side, we made that finding that having both of them before bedroom whole house rentals could in combination be a little much, so downscaling each though to a 3-bedroom use, ensuring there's a 1-bedroom for the resident at all times, would keep things in terms of their size and proximity to each other and able to meet this criterion. And then for A2, we imposed several conditions. We increased the quiet time from 10 to 7, now it's 9 to 8 via a condition of approval. Explicitly disallowed parties in large events, required posting of the house rules, required as proposed the single party rental and the reduced bedroom count, 3-bedroom, 6-guest count. And then there's a standard enforcement related condition that requires the applicant to just maintain guest data, you know, the frequency and number of guests. In case there's a question, the city can request it later. Criterion B for physical compatibility, there really wasn't much to talk about here. There's no scenic resources on the site, no physical changes to the property. It will continue to look physically like a single family house. So no real issues there. Under criterion C, livability, I think this is also where the neighbors have issues. C1 and 2, noise in particular, and then privacy and safety. Staff found there's no likely lighting, odor, or litter impacts from the use. And to address noise, as mentioned already, we have a condition reducing the quiet time, or increasing the quiet time, sorry, I've said that wrong twice now, increasing the quiet time to be from 9 p.m. to 8 a.m. via condition of approval, disallowing non-guest visitors and parties, and requiring an outreach once annually to let nearby immediately abutting neighbors, directly abutting the site and across the street, once a year, have contact information for the resident and operators. Excuse me. And then with regarding to privacy and safety, there's a standard inspection they have to do just to make sure the rooms have smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors and the egress for a fire, which they all would. It's a brand new house. And then again, quiet hours to limiting privacy and safety impacts by keeping most activity indoors late in the evening. There weren't much in the way of public service issues, and I don't have PBOT staff here today. If there's some issue, we'll end up having to request that the record be held open to submit more PBOT stuff. Their analysis was based on the four-bedroom use prior to our land use staff reducing it to three. So they did their analysis and recommendations based on the applicant's original proposal of four bedrooms. They'd found that the new trips will not negatively will not have a negative impact on adjacent street functions or on-street parking. They do have a condition of approval requested in their response that the applicant enforce their transportation demand management measures, and then some clarifications that they provide some basically information for all the guests about using the on-site parking, using the driveways before parking on the street, and then providing some information about nearby transit service, how to walk to the grocery store, down to McAdam, and the bus lines, etc. There were no issues with water, fire, sanitary stormwater, or police services. There is one relevant neighborhood plan per Criterion E. Staff and the Neighborhood Association agreed and only mentioned two goals, goal one and goal seven. Goal one is retain and enhance Terwilliger, which is the sub area of the plan that the site is located within. We're not in the Corbett area or the Lair Hill area. We're just in the Terwilliger area. There's three sub areas in that plan. So for this area, one of the goals, retain and enhance Terwilliger as a primarily low single family density, duplex density residential neighborhood. Basically, City Council, by passing the regulations for 207 and deeming these uses accessory to household living, staff and the zoning code's opinion is that, yeah, if it conforms to what an ASDR is supposed to conform to, then that's part of a household living use, so there's no conflict. And then with regards to goal seven, there is neighborhood concern about through traffic through the neighborhood. Staff's argument is basically that people are just going to be coming to the site and going, you know, probably from one direction, most likely from the downtown side or the airport side. And so they're not doing a lot of through traffic as a result of this proposal. They're coming to the ASDR and then turning around and going back the same way, so that wouldn't result in through traffic. The applicant's appeal statement, pretty brief, residential character of the area will be lessened due to this use in conjunction with other similar uses nearby, and there'll be adverse impacts on livability due to privacy and safety issues. I know they'll elaborate on those today. I'm not going to go into the details on the decision here. They are identical. Both cases are identical. The findings are identical. The only place they vary is really the site and zoning description. And I was very careful to, the same F letters or exhibits are the same in each file. And I submitted some new letters today that were the same for each file. So pretty much there's a virtual parallel construction between the findings. Let's see, just quickly through the conditions, modifying the house rules and the late night times under A, verifying commercial meetings are prohibited at the site under B, requiring that advertisements list the number of bedrooms and guests, and that it's a whole house or single group rental, keeping the confirmation data over time about guests and frequency, the once annual notification to neighbors, the safety inspection, and then the PBOT related condition for maintaining their TDM plus providing the information about nearby services and transit, walking maps, etc. So the hearings officer has a standard three conditions, grant appeal in part, and modify or deny the appeal and approve. And that is all I have.
All right, I only have one question, and it presupposes, I think I know the answer, having read the staff decision or administrative decision in each case, but when I was reading them, there was a little element of uncertainty, and I just want to make sure. I'm going to Mr. Robinson's letter, which was received last week by the hearings office. It's Exhibit H3, and I'm going to just read you page 2 at the top of it. It says the director also approved the applications by limiting the rental of 3 bedrooms in each dwelling unit for 3 bedrooms for at least 270 days per year and 4 bedrooms for no more than 95 days per year. And I'm not sure that that is exactly the same as your approval language, and I would just like you to comment on that.
No. On another appeal I recently had here, we did that, but on this one, we did not. So the approval is written for 3 bedrooms and 6 guests at all times.
All right. Thank you. I have no additional questions at this time. This will be a time and a place for the appellant representative. If you'll come forward, identify yourself for the record. First name, last name, spell your last name, give us your mailing address, please.
My name is Jim Gardner. G-A-R-D-N-E-R. My address is 2930 Southwest 2nd Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97201.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Frank, and everyone else here this morning. We really appreciate the opportunity to come today to address the numerous ways that we feel that approval of a conditional use permit in these cases does not meet the applicable criteria in the Portland Zoning Code, specifically Title 33, more specifically 33.815.105. As the neighborhood's land use chairman, my testimony will identify the criteria by section and explain how we feel each is not met.
Okay.
Following my testimony, you'll hear from several nearby residents who will elaborate on these points and provide additional examples. Starting with Title 33.815.105 Section A, this addresses, as Mr. Moffitt said, the proportion of household living uses that would be allowed by this approval. And to sort of quote slash paraphrase, that section kind of sums up by saying that the overall residential appearance and function of the area will not be significantly lessened by the proposal by itself or in combination with other uses in the area. We feel that's one critical part of how this criterion should be evaluated. And these this lessening of the residential appearance and function would not be allowed due to the intensity and scale of the proposed use. So our assertion is that it's clear that the overall residential function of this area will be significantly lessened by this approval. Renting 6 rooms at a time to up to 12 people will significantly increase the coming and going activity compared to a normal residential neighborhood. These are 2 newly constructed houses that are already out of scale with the nearby homes. The Neighborhood Association was initially told that these both would be single-family occupied. If these 2 virtually whole house rentals are now allowed, the impacts would be similar to that of having 2 small hotels. A critical issue, as I mentioned in this criteria, is the cumulative impacts from this proposal and other uses in the area. Mr. Moffitt, in his decision and in his presentation, stated that there was only, that he found 1 legal short-term rental in the vicinity. The key word in that is legal, because as we all know, there are numerous active functioning short-term rentals properties in the city of Portland that have not been considered or have not been gone through the process of becoming legal in terms of getting a permit from the city. Moving on to point 815.105, section C, it addresses livability. Quote, the proposal will not have significant adverse impacts on the livability of nearby residential zone lands due to noise, glare from lights, late night operations, odors and litter, and privacy and safety issues. We are convinced that this proposal will have significant adverse impacts on the livability of nearby residentially zoned lands. These virtually whole house rentals will create much more noise and glare from headlights and other lights than would be normal for single family residences. The repeated influx of strangers, numerous strangers, into and out of the area will raise serious privacy and safety concerns for nearby residents. Moving on to section D of that section of the of Title 33, it addresses public services, and particularly section D, number 2, transportation system, and within that, A, under 2. The decision would have to find that the transportation system is capable of supporting the proposed use in addition to existing uses in the area. Again, you have that that provision that has to look at cumulative and overall impacts, not just this one property. The evaluation factors include safety, street capacity, level of service, connectivity, et cetera, and especially the one that we are concerned about is on-street parking impacts. And then it goes on to talk about how these factors can be mitigated or balanced by measures that may include transportation improvements to on-site circulation. Now, the streets near this proposed use have already experienced significant and fairly recent increases in traffic, and they already have a significant shortage of on-street parking. In fact, these transient parking impacts have been such that nearby residents recently initiated a proposal and started a process to create a residential parking permit program in the area. The addition of so many additional vehicles traveling to and from the site and the need for many to park on the street will exacerbate this already negative situation. We noted that the as part of the documentation, the actual application also included a traffic impact study performed by Kittleson and Associates. We also noted that it was very inadequate in that it only assessed the actual impacts of what two bedrooms would be, as though that were all that was being proposed here and all that was approved here. When actuality, of course, we're talking about a total of six bedrooms that as this entire process has recognized, are really in most ways one and the same. It's almost a single concentrated use that happens to involve two properties and two specific case numbers. And we also note that part of the proposal proposed that there'd be some on-site parking spaces provided for overnight guests. We feel that these are far from adequate to really mitigate the impacts from so many users, particularly if there's going to have to be, under the approval criteria or approval condition, if there's going to have to be at least one resident owner occupying one of the four bedrooms in each house, that almost by necessity means that one of those on-site parking spaces would have to be kept for the use of that on-site resident owner. So you'd have even fewer available for overnight guests. Now, moving on to the last section of point 815.105, that's section E, which addresses the area plans, and it requires that the proposal be consistent with any area plans adopted by City Council, such as neighborhood plans. The applicable neighborhood plan here is the Cobertura or Lair Hill policy plan that was adopted by Portland City Council. And specifically, goal one of that plan for the Terwilliger portion of our neighborhood says the goal is to retain and enhance Terwilliger as a primarily low, and that is in parentheses, single family slash duplex density residential neighborhood. The rental of these six bedrooms to as many as 12 people does not retain or enhance the single family character of the neighborhood. In its actual impact, Again, this proposal will be similar to those in areas of commercial and institutional uses. In addition, within the CTLH policy plan, there is a specific policy that says to reduce vehicular traffic through residential neighborhoods. This policy, again, will be violated because these short-term rentals will result in a significant increase, not a reduction, in vehicle traffic in the vicinity, and at a level far exceeding, again, a typical single-family residential site. Again, I very much appreciate this opportunity, and I appreciate your attention to my testimony, and I ask that these points be carefully considered in your decision. It is notable that the Bureau of Development Services decision on this proposal took far longer than normal for such use cases. We believe this is because the applicants are apparently willing to spend as much time and resources and as many consultants and representatives as necessary to obtain this permit. It's clear to us that that fact further demonstrates that the fundamental purpose is commercial rather than residential. I'll be pleased to respond to any questions you may have, and if there are none, I thank you.
Okay. You're going to have an opportunity for rebuttal. I do actually have a couple questions for you, but I'm going to wait until I've heard all of the testimony before I ask those questions rather than taint any testimony that might come up during the process. Okay. But I appreciate your testimony. This will be the time and the place. Thank you, sir. Sure. This will be the time and the place for anyone else who wishes to support the appeal position.
Good morning. I'm Tom W. Gornick.
All right, I'm going to have to make a disclosure here. I didn't realize this, and I didn't recognize you without my glasses. You live next door to where my son used to live, didn't you? You live on California?
Yes.
Yep. All right. My son used to live in California.
Okay.
Right. Didn't recognize your name. Just immediately above.
Oh, okay.
All right. Sorry. I don't believe this is going to disqualify me from hearing this case. However, there is the risk that it could. And so if it does, I want to make sure that I've heard this testimony first before I decide whether or not I'm going to have to disqualify myself. I did not recognize you in the audience. That shows how familiar we are with each other. Go ahead, sir. Identify yourself for the record again.
Okay, I'm Thomas W. Gornick. I live at 0422.
Spell your last name, please.
G-O-R-N-I-C-K. I reside at 0422 Southwest California, Portland, Oregon, 97219. My wife and I reside on Southwest California, which is just a few blocks from the property in question. I'm also a board member of the South Portland Neighborhood Association. I appear in support of the South Portland Neighborhood Association appeal in these two matters. I oppose each of these two proposed ASTR conversions. My wife and I moved into our home 20 years ago at a time our neighborhood was in transition. Older residents were beginning to sell to younger families. These new owners and improvements made changes for the betterment. But most important, the new residents revitalized the neighborhood along Southwest Virginia from Southwest Pendleton to Southwest Taylor's Ferry. The area now has families with young children again. In fact, we have a school bus stop on Southwest Virginia for the first time since we moved into the community. I begin with that brief overview because our neighborhood is exactly what Portland and the city leadership wants to happen throughout our city. Now, regarding the two proposed units, as other submitted testimony states, approval was done without regard for cumulative impact. Portland City Code 33.815.010, which is the purpose section of the code, specifically notes that, quote, a review of these uses is necessary due to the potential individual or cumulative impacts that may have on the surrounding area or neighborhood. There is no evidence the city or the applicant conducted a cumulative impact review for either of these two, much less both or both in combination with the other same neighborhood ASTR approvals. There is no indication that the city calculated the number of such ASTRs or similar apartment building units that have been approved in the Johns Landing, or for that matter, the Corbett to Williger Lair Hill planning area. Nor is there any evidence that the city evaluated the number of pending applications for ASTRs in either area. Without knowing how many of these ASTRs have already been approved and how many applications are currently pending for the same sort of conversion, it is impossible for the city to claim that he evaluated the cumulative impact of these two additional ASTRs. If the city had done some simple web searches, they would have found there are multiple units within a half mile. For the record, let me list what I have found with just minimal effort. Number one, Fulton House Bed and Breakfast, 7006 Southwest Virginia. Non-owner caretaker on the site. They offer four bedrooms, double occupancy, eight persons. Number two, 0406 Southwest California Street, next door to my home. Standalone home, no owner present, three bedrooms, double occupancy for six persons. Number three, 0342 Southwest Dakota, four bedrooms, eight person occupancy, on-site management not indicated. Southwest Vermont, four bedrooms, eight-person occupancy, on-site management not indicated. Each of these units are just off a six-block northbound walk on Virginia for a total of 15 bedrooms with a 30-person occupancy. The three newest units do not have clear evidence that they are owner-occupied while offering the services. If the city denies this appeal, they should simply rename Southwest Virginia Motel Lane. I need not remind the hearing that this is not a commercial zone, but residential, made up of families, seniors, etc., all paying taxes, members of our taxpayers, members of this community. In addition to these less than three blocks to the east, across McAdam, there are two units listed on Southwest Miles, and on the hill just above the units in question, there is a three-bedroom, six-person occupancy listed on LaVue, and a single unit on Southwest Corbett. To repeat, as required by city code, there is no indication that the city calculated the number of such ASTRs or similar units in the area before the approval. The city has failed to follow the code, and its failure threatens the quality of our neighborhood. Supporting this appeal will be a decision, most importantly, to reinforce the city code, but also ensures that our neighborhood remains a community with a quality of life that Portland is struggling to maintain and grow. Supporting this appeal contributes to the security and safety of the current residents and homeowners, a place where neighbors recognize and support each other and do not worry about the stranger known only by an internet reservation with no stake in our neighborhood. Again, supporting this appeal keeps Southwest Virginia a neighborhood street and does not make it Motel Lane. We already have 15 units with 30% occupancy within a half mile of the property under consideration. Approve this appeal. Do not create two more motels in our neighborhood. Thank you.
Mr. Gornick, what I'd like you to do is stay there. Mr. Robinson, if you'd come up, please. I want to get rid of this process right now. Mm-hmm. Because this was a surprise to me. And my son lives next door to Mr. Gornick, did live mm-hmm. next door to this. He hasn't for about a year and a half, 2 years. Mm-hmm. I don't know what he does with his property. He owns a whole lot of more properties than just this one. And I haven't talked to him about this particular property. And I don't know what he's doing with it now. Mm-hmm. All right. So I have not advised him, nor has I counseled him, nor have I talked to him about this particular property. But I have met Mr. Gornick, and that was an omission on my part that I feel incredibly bad about. Number one, that I didn't recognize you.
Nor you, it's my fault as well.
But more importantly is that the issues raised, I believe that you raised one of the properties, which is one owned by my son. Mm-hmm. And not known to me. So what I need to do is find out whether or not, and I'm Mr. Gardner, I'm going to ask you to nod and I will represent your nod, either a nod or no. But based on my disclosure, I'm going to ask Mr. Gornick, do you have any problems in me making a decision in this case?
Oh, not at all.
All right, Mr. Robinson, I'm going to identify Michael Robinson representing the applicant. Do you have any problems in me representing,
making this decision? Not object.
Huh?
Applicant does not object.
All right, Mr. Gardner, it's an important decision on this one. I can't underemphasize the fact that I did not anticipate this happening. The amount that I see, my son lives in Washington up towards Seattle now. Mm-hmm. We see him very seldom, and we never talk. This isn't the first item that comes up in discussions, but it is something that someone would have an opportunity to raise as an objection. Mr. Gardner, do you object to me continuing to hear this case? No. Is there anybody else in the room that would object? All right, and I can't, thank you, Mr. Robinson.
You're welcome.
I can't tell you how sorry I am that I probably shouldn't have taken the case in the first place, but I didn't anticipate, he doesn't live here anymore, he doesn't even live in the state anymore, and I just didn't anticipate this would be an issue. And if I couldn't hear cases where he here owns property, I couldn't hear cases probably in the city of Portland, because he owns a number of properties throughout Portland. Not big ones, just yeah. little ones. So I apologize for that, Mr. Gornick.
And I have no objections, like I said. I didn't even know you did this, so this is.
Well, thank you for that part. It's one of the reasons I hide from almost everyone, including everyone in this building, so that I don't have disclosures in embarrassing moments like this. Thank you very much. Does anyone else wish to testify in opposition, which is in support of the appeal?
Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to
speak. Up, please.
Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to speak. My name is Bruce Carocci, C-A-R-O-C-C-I. My address is 18051 Southwest Lower Boones Ferry Road, apartment 149, Tigard, 97224.
Go ahead, sir.
My family has owned the two properties adjacent to the properties in question here, just to the north, for over 50 years. So we've seen a lot of changes, and recently a lot of those changes have been good in terms of some new houses, people upgrade, moving in, upgrading their existing houses. However, this approved permit takes the neighborhood in the other direction. It is, since Jim and Tom have spoken, I think, very thoroughly to the issues, I will not retread a lot of that, but just in summary say that the decision is in 180 degree opposition to the Portland City Codes regarding livability in terms of the noise, potential for late night operation, and not retaining or enhancing the single family nature of the neighborhood. And it's obviously a goal is to reduce traffic. This takes the traffic in the other direction. So just in summary, I have to be blunt. I find the staff findings as presented, they defy logic. In essence, they're saying there is going to be no impact from this additional tenancy in the neighborhood, and I find that astounding. So I hope that the appeal is upheld. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carucci. Anyone else wish to testify? Yes, ma'am.
Hi. My name is Jeannie Galick, G-A-L-I-C-K. I live at 7005 Southwest Virginia.
Could you spell your first name? Because I think I can misspell it.
J-E-A-N-N-E.
Thank you. Go ahead, ma'am. And did we get her address? Zip code, please.
97219. I live approximately one block away from these two properties, and I've lived there for 32 years. So I, like Tom, has seen a lot of changes within Virginia. Let me first talk about the actual conditional use. And by the way, when staff gives their report, please also mention these are two properties. It was very confusing to me because you were referencing.
Okay, you need to talk to me because I'm
one property and three bedrooms, when it's actually two properties we're discussing and six rental bedrooms.
And I have full acknowledgement of that.
Okay. The proposed ASTR conditional use should be denied. It fails to meet code 33815105E, stating that the proposal be consistent with any area plans adopted by the City Council as part of the comprehensive plan, such as neighborhood or a community plan. The ASTR runs counter to key portions of our neighborhood plan. Again, it's goal one, retain and enhance Terwilliger as a primarily low, and by that single family or duplex, density residential neighborhood. And secondly, reduce vehicular traffic through residential neighborhoods. Less than half of our neighborhood is zoned for single family use, far less than most other neighborhoods. Virginia Avenue is R5 only on the west side. The east side is a mixture of condos, townhouses, single family homes, apartments, and one bed and breakfast. The properties under consideration are both on the west side. Allowing short-term rentals within this narrow band of single family homes is essentially spot zoning. It is vital to our area's rich mix of housing to retain the limited single-family residences that we now have. These are residents who have put down roots and made a commitment to our community. They are here for the long term, not for the night. Single-family homes, as well as long-term rentals, provide stability and anchor for building a sustainable, healthy, and livable community. The effect of removing two single-family homes in this narrow band and adding six rental bedrooms is really diluting our residential community. The proposed ASTR does not meet goal one of our neighborhood plan, which is to retain and enhance Terwilliger as primarily a low density residential neighborhood. Again, this is a very narrow band of properties that are low, are single family homes. And we are already, just in the last year, we have had 140 apartments built on Pendleton and Virginia. So it's not a density question, it is actually trying to retain single family homes in this area. To understand the negative impacts of increased vehicle congestion, one must understand the geography of this portion of Virginia Avenue. McAdam, or Highway 43, is to the east and a steep hill to the west. There are no through side streets to mitigate or dilute parking, and the traffic pressures the street is already experiencing. Adding six rental units will only worsen the congestion problems by exceeding typical residential use. We feel that this, again, does not meet the neighborhood plan. And as a long-term resident on Virginia Avenue, I can tell you that I cannot back out of my driveway during evening rush hour. I don't know if the planner has visited our area during that time, but Virginia Avenue, being the only other street parallel to McAdam, is a cut-through for all west side traffic going up into the hills. So we have terrific traffic issues during the evening rush hour. And we also have very poor parking, again, because we have such limited geography. So thank you very much. I hope
you
turn
ma'am.
This down.
Anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
My name is Sarah Bradley, B-R-A-D-L-E-Y. I live at 6615 Southwest Virginia. Thank you, Mr. Frank, for hearing input from the community. I'm just going to read. I've actually got two letters for both units that I'll just submit, but I'll just read one. I reside at 6615 Southwest Virginia and consider this conditional use to be inconsistent with the city's housing goals, and in addition believe the request does not meet several of the conditional use criteria. Specifically, this conditional use does not meet the 33.815.105 approval criteria on proportion of household living uses, livability, public services, and the area plan. Criteria A of the conditional use approval states that the appearance and function of the area will not be significantly lessened, and criteria C states the proposal will not have significant adverse effects on the livability of nearby residential zone lands. The conditional use approval of this property and its adjacent property and will significantly impact the area and the impact the livability of the nearby properties, as my neighbors have already testified to. Short-term rental of up to 6 units in the neighborhood, which could be up to 12 additional people, will have a significant increase in traffic coming and going from the property. I, like the previous person, live on Virginia and cannot get out of my driveway at rush hour. The increased traffic will impact the noise and safety of the neighborhood. There will also be a decrease in accessible street parking for neighboring properties, as this property can only accommodate 2 vehicles. And as stated earlier, if one of them is saved for a permanent resident, then that's only 1 parking spots. There will be an increase in noise, as single-family neighborhoods have an average of 2.3 people per household, and this conditional use will increase the household size to 6. Finally, the nature of short-term rentals is inconsistent with the function of a single-family neighborhood, as transient guests do not build community ties or contribute to the neighborhood, which impacts livability for the entire neighborhood. Criteria D identifies safety, street capacity, level of service, connectivity, transit, availability of pedestrian bike networks, on-street parking, blah, 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 you know it, as factors to evaluate in approving a conditional use. Already, this neighborhood is used as a thoroughfare during rush hour to avoid the traffic on McAdam, and there is a shortage of street parking due to the lack of adequate parking for multifamily units and the use of street parking by commuters to downtown and OHSU. You can't park in my neighborhood during the day because there is because of the commuters that use the bus lines, and I use the bus. I'm faculty at Portland State. I use the bus, and I see everybody get on the bus at OHSU and get off in our neighborhood and pick up their cars and drive out of the neighborhood. So we have 2-car parking, and when we have more than 2 people, you can't park in our neighborhood during the day. You have to go about 4 blocks away, and I live about 6 blocks from these proposed buildings. Finally, this conditional use does not align with the Corbett-Terwilliger-Lair plan policy goal to retain and enhance the neighborhood, as stated earlier. The use is also does not align with the intent of the city's new zoning code, which designates the neighborhood as a single dwelling zone. I support the city's new zoning codes with a focus on increasing density in single-family neighborhoods in order to meet the housing needs of the community. This conditional use application is inconsistent with those goals, as it removes a single family residence or two from the city's housing stock, thereby increasing housing costs to members of the community. In this way, it impacts livability for more than just the neighborhood, but for the entire community. I am not opposed to short-term rentals, and if the applicant had applied for the lower standard of 1 to 2 bedrooms, I wouldn't be here, but because that would mean that they would actually be residing in the house, but whole house rentals are inconsistent with the single family neighborhood and the sense of community. So thank you for considering my input, and I request that the city reverse the approval of the conditional use, and I ask that the hearing remain open.
Thank you, ma'am. And no one else needs to ask about the record to remain open. At the end of the hearing, I will talk about the logistics of getting information into the record, the dates when things happen, and all that kind of business. All right, is there anyone else wishing to testify in support of the appeal? This will be the time and the place for the applicant's applicant's representative.
Good morning, Mr. Frank. My name is Michael Robinson. My last name is spelled R-O-B-I-N-S-O-N. My mailing address is 1211 Southwest Fifth Avenue, Suite 1900, Portland, Oregon, 97204. I'm here today on behalf of the applicant. Also with me is Ms. Jennifer Nye. I'm going to let Jennifer introduce herself, then I'm going to talk for a few moments, and then Jennifer will take the remainder of the time.
That's fine.
Jennifer Nye with William Wilson Architects, 1022 Southwest.
Okay, you're going to have to speak a whole lot slower than that. I got lost on the Jennifer part.
Oh, Jennifer Nye, William Wilson Architects, 1022 Southwest Salmon Street, Suite 300, Portland,
spell
Oregon.
Spell your last name and give us your zip code again.
Nye, N-Y-E, 97205.
Got it. Go ahead, ma'am.
I think Mike was going to speak first.
Okay.
Testify. So, Mr. Frank, two things initially. One is I did not hear you, and I apologize for raising this, but I want to make sure that the public understands it. I didn't hear the sufficient specificity language from the 197-763-5 statement. I just wanted to bring that to the hearings officer's attention.
And I'll let you make the statement, and I will either agree or disagree.
Parties are required to raise with sufficient specificity so that the decision maker and other parties understand the issue they're raising, and if they fail to do that, the issue is waived if they go to LUBA on appeal.
All right. What Mr. Robinson just said, so the audience understands, is the Land Use Board of Appeals is, in essence, a land use court, for lack of a better way to put it. And they're a busy group. And I'm talking sort of generalities and background. So when there is an appeal to the Land Use Board of Appeals, they want the issues narrowly focused, sufficient that at this level, all sides have an opportunity to knowledgeably respond to those issues, all right? What Mr. Robinson has said is if you don't raise issues with sufficient specificity in order for me or in everyone else in this room or anyone else who might respond to be able to respond knowledgeably and precisely, then it is a possibility that the Land Use Board of Appeals won't consider that issue. Is that a fair representation?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, sir.
And my second issue was, thank you for correcting my point in the letter. That the piece that you noted and you asked Mr. Moffitt about should have come out of the letter. So I agree with what the, essentially, I understand what the decision was in the letter. I'll send in a revised August 10th letter so it's correct. So a couple of points. First of all, the applicant agrees with the director's decision for both addresses. We think the findings are adequate and they're supported by substantial evidence in the whole record. Secondly, we agree with the conditions of approval. We think the director's decision did a good job of identifying conditions that implement and satisfy the approval criteria in 815-105 and 33-207. And in our opinion, all of the conditions are feasible to be implemented. There's nothing difficult about them. They're clear and objective. I also want to note, and we'll talk more about this in our rebuttal, but there are really three main issues we've heard about today. First is an allegation that there are other ASTRs in the area. And I think the staff report at page 5 of both decisions did a good job of addressing this. The staff report notes that there's only one other legal ASTR in the area. And that, of course, is what 33-815-105A and A1 are all about, is legal uses. If we considered uses which are unlawful or apparently unlawful, then the city has no control over those except through enforcement, and that's not what this criteria means. It's an analysis of lawful uses, both permitted and in existence in the R5 zone. So if you have an allegation that there are unlawful uses, that's clearly not what that criterion is talking about. Secondly, the issues raised with regard to livability are well addressed through the conditions of approval in both decisions, which the applicant agrees with. They are feasibly satisfied. They implement both 105 and 815-105 and 33-207, and are in sum able to address the livability issues. The last main issue has to do with traffic. The Portland Bureau of Transportation comments are substantial evidence in the whole record. There's no substantial evidence that's contrary to PBOT's finding, and as we'll explain in rebuttal, PBOT addressed Their comments and evidence address the issues regarding traffic generation and parking. And I guess I might add a fourth issue, which are the area plans, Goal 1 and Goal 7. I don't think Goal 1 is affected at all about this. I think the staff analysis on Goal 1 is entirely accurate. Goal 7 is not relevant because this is not through traffic. This is destination traffic, and that's not what Goal 7 talks about. So for all of those reasons, plus the other argument and evidence already in the record supporting the application, we ask that the hearings officer reject the appeals and approve the applications. And I'll turn it back over to Jennifer.
Go ahead, ma'am.
I think the only thing I have to add is that we did a transportation management plan with Kittleston and came up with options to help reduce parking impacts, but also the houses have three legal parking stalls and can likely park much more than three vehicles each. And a reminder that as an ASTR, it is a primarily a household use, and it is resident occupied. So the owners of both houses are long-term owners of the neighborhood and heavily invested in the neighborhood and want the livability as well.
Thank you, ma'am. Anything further, Mr. Robinson?
Not at this time.
All right. Anyone else wishing to testify in support of the application in opposition to the appeal? Seeing none, Mr. Moffitt.
I didn't hear anything that jumped out at me that felt like it needed to be added or commented on.
Mr. Gardner.
Yes.
You're up.
Should I identify myself again? James?
Just Jim Gardner. Gardner.
Jim Gardner.
That'll work.
Okay. You have my address.
We do.
You know where to find me.
Yes, I think we do.
Just two or three brief remarks that I guess could be considered rebuttal of points that have been raised here. One to what we just heard, and it has to do with the difference between other legal ASTRs in the vicinity versus other ASTRs in the vicinity. To restrict consideration of only the legal, and by that, I assume everyone means properties that have gone through the City of Portland's permit process for short-term rentals, and specifically for the one- and two-bedroom, smaller-scale short-term rentals, to restrict consideration to only those few who have gone through that process and become, quote-unquote, legal, is really living in an artificial world. It's common knowledge in the City of Portland. It has been well documented through numerous articles in various media, The Oregonian, Willamette Week, that there are far more unlicensed ASTRs in the City of Portland than those that have gone through that permitting process. So again, to try to constrict and restrict only consideration of that single nearby legal ASTR is an artificial construct. Another very different point has to do with the various conditions, some of them that were in the decision attached to how the properties would be operated, particularly the reports of the rentals on a periodic basis that need to be submitted supposedly to the city and to some identified nearby neighbors, and also information about the quiet hours and the other rules of operation. In reality, these conditions have and will have very little real-world impact. The City of Portland has little resources or programs to enforce such conditions. We've seen, I have experienced even just as our land use chairman, that conditions over the years wind up being ignored by the initial applicants, and occasionally when they are reported to the city, essentially nothing is done. There really is not the mechanism or even the specific rules to enforce all of the conditions of this type as time goes on. those essentially are the two points that I want to make rebuttal comments about. Again, the key issue to us is whether running these small rental hotels, in effect, with three or four bedrooms in each one, will fundamentally change the character of that street. We have, frankly, serious doubts about the other condition, about the owner occupancy of each, at least one bedroom in each of these houses. You may note that the original proposal was that they be allowed to have entirely four bedrooms at each place available for rent, in which case there would be no resident manager, no owner occupant there. It is, again, to us who live nearby, not believable, not credible, that even that restriction to be able to only rent three bedrooms at a time will actually be followed and enforced.
All right, I'm going to hold you there just for a sec, because I told you I probably was going to have some questions, but I was going to wait until everything was said and done. Now, for God's sake, I've probably forgotten questions, but let me make sure. I guess I'm going to start at just what you said, all right, as far as Mr. Robinson's argument that I only consider legal ASTRs, and your argument that I consider, because of reality, all ASTRs. All right. I don't know how to put this that doesn't come off a slight, that I might be giving one side or the other a slight advantage, and God forbid, after my disclosure, am I a little nervous about that. But I started out, and I think I'm on fairly safe grounds, that I started out my comments, or early in my comments, before everybody else started talking, and said that my decision is not going to be made in what I like or don't like. I don't get to do that. And I have prided myself for the last 18 years being here that I don't do that, all right? I don't decide what I like and don't like. In fact, my clerks will certainly confirm that I may walk out of after a decision and say, damn, I think that's a terrible decision practically, but legally speaking, it's supportable. And that underlines the issue here is that I only can consider what is in the code, all right? And you've done, and I appreciate all parties or all persons who've testified today have made a very good shot at identifying 33.815.105, something or other, or 207. I appreciate that. And that goes at least as a step in the right direction to Mr. Robinson's concern about raising issues with specificity, all right? So that's good. But it also comes down to what does 33.815.105A, I guess it's one, the proportionality one, and its precedent, or the one just front, what does that really mean? And it doesn't, it may or may not mean what is practical. It may or may not mean what is the real world, and I'm using a different word is if I found contrary to what a couple of you have testified on the appeal, it would make a mockery of reality. In other words, this is really what it is, and these things, you use that in context of conditions and who lives there and those kind of things. Right. I'm simply telling you right now, I don't know what the answer is with respect to whether only legal uses, as represented by Mr. Robinson, or unlawful or practical uses are. But I'm telling you that you're going to have a week,
And I'm going to tell you that you are at a slight disadvantage without legal counsel. I didn't say significant, I'm saying slight. I respect you as the land use chair, and I understand that you have experience, but I'm going to tell you that we are going to come down, I am going to come down and make a decision as to whether or not Mr. Robinson is correct that the intent of council when enacting the 33.815.105 was to consider legal or not. And so I'm telling you right now that it's kind of like one of those machines that in the lottery that has all the balls flying in the air. I don't know which one I'm going to pick yet, but I will tell you I'm going to pick the easiest one that I can catch. And that simply means the one that gives me the best legal support for that interpretation. And there's been a number of issues that have been raised by Mr. Robinson and been raised by you that are in the same sort of category. There's been representations that the neighborhood plan 1 applies or doesn't apply, or 7 applies or doesn't apply. It's through traffic or not through traffic. I'm going to tell you that when I write a decision, I look at each and every one of those complaints, objections, comments, and then I'm going to go back and look and see what the code says. And I'm telling you that you have, as the neighborhood chair, as the primary appellant, you have the obligation to convince me that you are legally correct. That may not be reality correct. That may not be real world correct. For example, somebody raised the purpose section. It may have been Mr. Gornick. I will tell you right now, Mr. Robinson probably won't be very happy with this, but I will tell you right now, purpose sections are not approval criteria. They are to be used at best to interpret approval criteria. So if you tell me that there's a failure of an approval criteria because it doesn't meet the purpose section, legally speaking, you lose. All right? So those are sort of my overview comments that I'm trying to give you as the appellant, that a number of things have been brought up. For example, there is the word character shows up in your appeal statement. If you're going to use the word appeal character, tell me what approval criteria character comes from, all right? You don't have to respond right now. You've got a week to do that, but I'm trying to tell you that reality and the law may or may not overlap. And you need to focus on the legal aspects of the code. And I would suggest that you go back and ask yourself, and you may want to even actually talk to Mr. Moffitt about this, but when City Council passed the ASTR code section, they didn't pass it and say that ASTRs are commercial uses. So when I hear the word commercial use, that's a reality thing. That's a feeling thing. That's an impression thing. When I hear the word commercial, I don't know where that fits in the ASTR. The ASTR, our ASTR ordinance code is in place, and that's all I can deal with. Not what it might have long-term ramifications, not that it shouldn't be fixed, but that's what we're going to deal with, and that's what you're going to deal with if you want to be successful in this appeal. All right? Mr. Robinson raised an issue with respect to the transportation. I may have misunderstood this, and I don't know who the person was that testified that the transportation analysis, the traffic analysis, was done on 2 bedrooms per, and I may have just misunderstood this, and I will apologize for that. 2 bedrooms per house.
I would like Mr. Robinson and his side to be able to respond to that, and I need you to respond to that. If not, Mr. Robinson raised a point, and it's part of the learning process, in my opinion, as being a land use chair and being responsible for these kind of cases, is that I am responsible to make a decision based on what's called substantial evidence in the record. If you go to Luba's website, you can actually pull up headnotes and there's substantial evidence, and you now have a probably 20 or 30 hour research project. But I will tell you, there's just oodles of cases discussing what substantial evidence is. Substantial evidence usually is not opinion by laypersons as compared to opinion by an expert. My understanding is, from what Mr. Robinson is telling me, is that they have a transportation study done by a entity that has a professional reputation, I'm assuming, and I'm not saying they do, just because I will assure you that particular company has had problems with me in not so far away from you. But I will tell you that you're saying that there's too much traffic. You're saying that there's too much cut through. You're saying that there's no parking. If in fact that transportation study contradicts that, then I'm going to look at the professional statement as being the substantial evidence as compared to just lay or opinion evidence of someone who is not professionally qualified. Do you understand?
Yes.
All right. So I'm trying to even up to some extent the playing field. But the facts are almost, I don't care how much television you watch with lawyers and all that stuff, you know, and trial kinds of things. When it comes down to it, substantial evidence, which is facts in a case, almost always wins, and following the law almost always wins in every legal case. When you start a case, it's even. You find the facts, you find the law. Mr. Robinson finds the facts, he finds the law. I make a decision as to who has the more substantial argument, the more persuasive argument. All right? So that's the limit of my giving you a bringing you up to speed and bringing you even. But I will tell you right now, based on the testimony that I have on the record, particularly, let's see, by Ms. Galick, I think it is. I think is talking about, you were talking about, one of you were talking about backing out. I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah.
That is very interesting evidence, but I'm going to look at that in comparison to the traffic study or the parking study or whatever it happens to be. All right. What I don't see from either of you is any empirical evidence as to why 8 may not be bad, or 8 is bad. I'm talking from the city's perspective. 8 is bad, 6 is good, 4 is better, or 2 is best. I'm making, that's a hypothetical statement. Don't take it seriously, all right?
Yeah.
But the point is that the city has argued, and the city now has an obligation, and the city, based on some recent hearings that I've had and I'm aware of, this is a real challenge for them, is what, in fact, makes 105, the proportionality argument, tip one direction or another, or what tips the livability argument one way or the other, or what conditions are necessary. Okay. So I'm telling the city that right now, I have a recommendation for 6 on each side, 12 total. Yes, I understand there's 2. 12 total. How do those impacts really, where are those impacts really coming from? okay? Where are those impacts really coming from? And I believe that 6 versus 8, I'm talking from Mr. Robinson's perspective, quite honestly, 12 to 16, I don't see the difference in some respects. Or 10 to 12, what's the difference? And I would like some help in knowing why 12 is the correct number, 6 plus 6. I don't know where that is, okay? I don't know where that is. And I think the city has an obligation on the staff's perspective to help me out. But since we have an appeal, it seems to me that you have an obligation to help me out on that. The other part, and I guess I've taken up sort of your questions by kind of giving you some hints about what to do. But I, at this point in time, I believe that the conditions that have been proposed by the city and supported by Mr. Robinson seem pretty darn reasonable. Now, you're saying that they may not work in reality. And you've got to convince me why that is a legal standard, that reality is a legal standard and simply imposing a condition is. I worked here for 16 years, full time. One of my obligations was to hear code cases, code violation cases. If you think you told me for the very first time I've ever heard it, that the City Bureau of Development Services staff isn't capable of enforcing all conditions, I will tell you that that's not the first time I heard it. But I will tell you that I'm not sure how that relates to imposing those conditions at this stage. Just because it doesn't always work doesn't mean that imposing conditions isn't appropriate. And at this point in time, the quiet hours condition seems relatively important. What doesn't make sense to me in conditions, and you can certainly respond to this one, is if in fact we have three, as Ms. Nye said, three legal parking spaces per side, okay, per unit. If in fact we have two single individuals and two couples coming on each side, maybe we have four cars coming on each side. Under the approval, where do those cars park? Because the way I read the approval is all cars must park on site. So it seems to me that somebody's going to have to help me on that. Okay? All right. So I guess I'm not going to ask you a whole lot more questions because I think it's more effective that you take the time to cogitate a bit and think about kind of the issues that I've raised. If you want to answer any questions in your rebuttal right now or make any final comments, you may. Mr. Gardner.
Just a couple of comments on points that you've raised. First, in terms of the question of whether there are significant other non-legal ASTRs in the area, Mr. Gornick's testimony, of course, included a list of addresses that he was able to do with, as he said, very minimal amount of research. I'm not sure personally what is in his written testimony that he submitted.
And I haven't seen it either.
But I do know that we can take steps to further document those claims that there are a significant number of other non-legalized ASTRs in the area. So I'm assuming that might at least be go some distance toward establishing that allegation as fact as opposed to just a person's personal opinion. So during the 7 days that we have open, we'll be sure to submit documentation. I guess my question is to what extent that would be necessary. Perhaps printouts from the various short-term rental applications and websites.
I leave that up to you.
Okay, we'll submit something along those lines.
I've given you a whole lot of advantage by telling you how I think and the things that are concerned to me. Mm-hmm. Now it's up to you to be the good wife lawyer or the Perry Mason lawyer or whoever it happens to be. Is you're going to have to, if you want to work on the substantial evidence side, that's your job, not mine. I called the Romans thumbs up, thumbs down, as I'm going to either agree with you or disagree with you. Seems to me you have a bigger threshold problem. As you got to answer whether or not Mr. Robinson's correct that we should only be considering legal uses as opposed to not or unlawful ones. Okay, and I'm not saying how to. I'm coming down on that. I'm simply telling you, it's a stepwise. I'm very linear in the way I think. And first of all, I have to decide what the law is. Secondly, is did you prove the law? Okay.
Well, to that, I'm not aware of any specific language in the Portland City Code that would really directly answer that question.
And I responded saying you may be at a slight disadvantage by not having a lawyer, because there is a whole interpretation analysis process that if you get PG Electricity, I'm giving you the name of the case, PG versus Boley and its progenitor, that talk about interpreting kinds of things like this. And I'm just telling you that it's for a lay person who has not done research in this area to try to catch up in 1 week to what a Mr. Robinson, for example, would know about that process. I think you're at a disadvantage, quite honestly. So if you don't know how to do that, that's a good indication that there may be a problem that needs to be assisted by someone else.
My only other comment has to do with your, I guess I would call it dilemma, in determining in your own mind if four bedrooms per house is too many, but according to the BDS staff, six is okay, and then you don't know whether is six better than four, is four better than two, et cetera. I guess I would only suggest that the city code itself, when they came to determining how to regulate ASTRs, made a clear distinction between, I guess, what would be called small scale versus larger scale.
So two versus more than two.
Two versus more than two. And right there has been a judgment call made by...
Don't disagree.
...through the legislative process to decide where the line should be drawn in terms of significant versus less significant impacts.
And we're now in the conditional use process because of that.
Because
over
of
two,
that.
And because we're in the conditional use process, if I use the word dilemma, I'm telling you that how do I satisfy the code? How do I satisfy the law? Is it with 12? Is it with 16? Is it with 8? You need to help me out on that.
Yeah,
and so does Mr. Robinson. And Mr. Robinson's agreed that 12 is okay, and so is Mr. Moffitt. But Mr. Moffitt is fully aware that this particular issue has been problematic to me in the past, and I'm using you as a tool. Maybe you can help me answer this question. Maybe you can help me interpret this law better, because this is, I would guess that there's been at least three or four ASTR cases in the last two or three months here. And one of the issues is almost always the number.
Sure.
So I'm just saying, why don't you do the hearings officer a favor, and that invitation's to Mr. Robinson as well. Do me a favor and help me, help staff, or have staff help me out with what the appropriate number is, and how do I justify that under the code? Okay, anything else?
Only that I would say I appreciate the time you've taken to provide some guidance, or at least some illumination of what the legal requirements will be.
Well, I think Mr. Moffitt would agree, because he's been in a number of cases, that if I have a downside as a hearings officer, is that I tend to tell people too much what I think at the hearing and what I'm going to be making my decision based on, and I don't keep it close to the vest and surprise people, and they say, well, geez, if I'd known that. I think even Mr. Robinson would probably agree that I tend to probably be pretty vocal, maybe talk too much on occasion, but I believe that the land use process is unique. Not every lawyer that comes in here, if they're not a land use lawyer per se, Mr. Robinson is. If you're not a land use lawyer, you're in over your head. And I get land use chairs like you who are sincere, hardworking, really conscientious people and understand some of the land use process, but it is a complicated process. And my feeling is that as a hearings officer, as I'm an extension sort of the city council, to the extent that I owe you an obligation, and Mr. Robinson and everyone else in this room an obligation to explain how these things are done and how decisions are made. Because the next time you come, you'll just be that much better prepared. And so I look at it as an educational process as well as an assist in the individual case. So that's my job, in my opinion. Not every hearings officer who works here at the City of Portland looks at it the same way. And I will assure you I do with these hearings throughout the state, and I can assure you that most of them throughout the state don't see this process the same way. I'm trying to be helpful to both sides. I'm not trying to give either side an advantage, but used to be we had another hearings officer, and he'd walk out and say, well, gee whiz, here's what happened. And I'd say, are you comfortable in your decision? Did you get everything that you could possibly extract? In other words, I'm trying to suck everything out of you and Mr. Robinson that I can. Because the more that I suck out of you, information-wise, legal-wise, the easier it is for me to make a good decision. That's all I'm trying to do. Okay, thank you. Mr. Robinson, you're up. And I realize that I probably tilted the scales a bit, and I'm not apologizing for it. You're a big boy, and you know how to handle it.
Mr. Frank, Mike Robinson, again, on behalf of the applicant. So the only thing I want to say in rebuttal, rather than being specific about the testimony offered today, is, as you've noted, this decision is all about, have the approval criteria been addressed with adequate findings, and are they supported by substantial evidence in the whole record? Nothing that we've heard today suggests that the director made a decision and suggests that there's any reason or legal basis for the hearings officer to reverse the director and deny the applications. I think the decisions are both well written, and the evidence, especially the substantial evidence regarding transportation and especially the well written conditions of approval, fundamentally and fully address all of the approval criteria. So with that, we'll just hang on to our other arguments for the written record period. I know the hearings officer's standard format is 3 1-7-day periods, the initial argument and evidence, rebuttal, and then final written argument for applicant, which we're not waiving. The only thing I was going to note before you set the schedule is, just looking at my calendar, I think that third period, the applicant's final written argument, lands on September 3, which is Labor Day, which is a state holiday, so we'd ask that you extend that to September 4. Okay. And that's all we have today.
All right, and Mr. Robinson, what he's done is look at what I have done on occasion in cases he's been involved with in the past. Historically, state law requires that I keep the record open for 7 days, and there's a 7-day rebuttal. And I, contrary to most other hearings officers, don't believe that anything beyond that is required. But as a practical matter, it seems to me as a matter of fairness that almost all the hearings officers have gone to that 3-week process, and I don't disagree with that, and I would be willing to do that if you don't have a problem with that.
I have. The applicant doesn't object.
Okay. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to go to 4 o'clock. All right. 4 o'clock on the 20th of August for new evidence, and I'm going to explain that in just a sec. You know that I'm going to talk longer than I should, so I will make sure you understand. There will be an additional period of rebuttal by everyone. Everyone. Okay? Actually, Mr. Robinson, I'm going to skip that. I'm not going to do that in this particular case. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go 1 week for new evidence, and I'm going to go to September 4th for rebuttal for both sides. Do you have any objection to that?
So 1 7-day period ending on August 20th, 4 p.m. for argument and evidence from anyone.
Hold up. So argument, yes, for the 20th.
And then a second 14-day period?
Yes.
For?
Final rebuttal for both sides.
Well, we get final written argument after the record is closed to all parties.
All right, then I'm going to go back. I just was waiting for you to bring it up. And you did.
I guess I wasn't asleep today. I'm sorry.
No. I was trying to pull one, and it didn't work.
You were?
I was.
Okay.
And it didn't work. All right. So here's what it is. Mr. Gardner, and you and all friends are going to have until the 27th at 4 o'clock. That includes Mr. Robinson as well. For any final rebuttal argument. And then, Mr. Robinson, you're going to have until 4 o'clock on September 4th for final rebuttal. Yep. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Frank.
Yes, thank you. And I wasn't going to let you get away with, I wasn't going to play the game that much on you. All right, here's what it means. Anyone's here or not here, so people are listening to the recording. Anyone who wishes to submit new evidence, may do so until August 20th, 2018 at 4 o'clock. Anyone. And I'm going to limit this to just the appellant, but Mr. Gardner, I would like all of it, since you seem to be kind of the focal point on this, I'm going to tell you that you have until 4 o'clock until September 27th to submit rebuttal.
September
27th? August 27th. Sorry. I was looking at September 4th and said the word wrong. So August 27th, 4 o'clock, for a rebuttal from appellant. And then the applicant has, as a matter of statutory right, has the final rebuttal until September 4th. New evidence means anything. But remember what anything means by my terminology? Relevant to the approval criteria. Okay? So new evidence related to the approval criteria should come in on or before 4 o'clock on the 20th of August. Mr. Gardner, you have the ability to respond to that, but not with new evidence. No new evidence. So from August 20th until the 27th, whenever you submit something to me, that will not include new evidence. The ogre part of my personality comes out. If there is any new evidence, I simply put it into a brown envelope, the entire document. Don't include new evidence. Rebuttal is, in essence, argument. Actually, if you look at statute, it says the word argument, okay? But if you respond, it will be an argument. So you can say, Mr. Robinson said and included the evidence such and such, and we disagree for the following reasons. Not new reasons, just reasons, okay? And Mr. Robinson is fully aware that his final rebuttal has the same limitation. He can include no new evidence, right? No new evidence. Now, I fully anticipate that somebody's going to want to come and see the record over the next week because rebuttal was kind of contingent on what somebody submits. So I'm assuming both the appellant and the applicant are going to want to come. Go out the door, give them the case numbers, take a look, get the copies of what you want, all right? Just telling you that's how you do it. How do you submit information to the hearings office? The information, the new evidence, doesn't go to Mr. Moffitt, doesn't go to wherever, city council, doesn't go anywhere else. It comes to this office. There's cards in the back. It's the where you are today, except next door, all right? So how do you get it here? Number one, the safest way is hand delivery, and this is a fairly short, because it's 7 days time period, so hand delivery is the safest. And this is one of the times where it's really nice not to have Centennial or Powellhurst or Forest Heights where they're way far away. You guys are actually relatively close. And so it's not so far away that it's totally inconvenient. I strongly suggest you hand deliver things. You hand deliver it to that window out there, the clerk will stamp it. Got at least one architect person here. Usually there's engineers here. I disregard anybody who thinks you're smarter than our timestamp. Our timestamp wins. I don't care if it's right or wrong, and it's within a minute or two, I can assure you. But whatever time it's received is what it's received. If it's received a minute, 4:01, for example. If it's received at 4:01, it's late. infamous brown envelope doesn't get read. Harsh. Very harsh. No late homework, right? So hand deliver it. Secondly is facts. I know hardly anybody knows what a fax is anymore, but we still accept them. If you send it, the number in the back is on our card in the back with a fax, and you may fax it. I don't know how faxes work, but they do stamp a time on it, a date and time. That is the time it's received. Right, wrong, or indifferent, that's the time it's received. If it's late, goes in the envelope. Finally, there's only the three ways. Finally, is you may mail it. Since these are fairly short time frames, mailing is a really risky process. All the time I was here, never understood how the City of Portland mail system worked. But what I did understand is when my clerk opens up the envelope and stamps it, it's received. So it isn't when you put it in the mailbox. It isn't when you go to the mail carrier or the mail post office and have them put some date on it. That's not what time it is. It's what time we receive it. Mailing probably is a bad idea in most of this case because the time periods are fairly short. So hand deliver, fax it, or mail it. Any questions about how to process? Yes, Mr. Robinson?
Well, I have a question about the open record, Kurt, that I can wait.
No, go ask it now. Microphone, please.
Mr. Frank, Mike Robinson again on behalf of the applicant. So would you mind, I may have misunderstood you, and I don't want to cause confusion either for my client or for the parties here today, but I want to make sure I understand what is going to happen. So can I repeat what I understood you to
please.
Say, please? So until August 20th at 4 p.m., you gave the three methods by which persons can submit evidence. But that 1 week period from today is for anyone to submit any argument or evidence, including
anyone.
New facts.
Right.
The second 7 day period ends on August 27th at 4 p.m. That is for rebuttal, argument, and use of facts already in the record by August 20th, but not new facts.
Correct.
And then the final.
And I've limited that to the appellant.
Well, you said, when I was up here, when you were up here, you said it was for both parties, and that was my understanding as well.
You want both weeks?
I may do that, because my letter on the 20th.
I will give it to the appellant and the applicant.
Thank you. And then until September 4th, which is a Tuesday at 4 p.m., for final written argument by applicant only, not including new evidence.
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Gardner, do you have any objections to that? One of the reasons I used to do just 7 and 7 is I didn't get in this who got the second week part. And I liked it a whole lot better, even though it seemed arbitrary and capricious.
Jim Gardner again for the appellant. I think I understand what I just heard, what Mr. Robinson said. What I want to absolutely clarify is that until 4 p.m. August 20th, anyone and everyone can submit any new evidence.
Anything they want.
For the period that would begin on August 20th and run through 4 p.m. on August 27th, the information that the appellant and the applicant can submit will be rebuttal to whatever may have come in during that
up
initial.
Up until the 20th.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Just now, no new evidence in that week period, and Mr. Robinson's following week doesn't get it either.
I guess my confusion somewhat is that the purpose or the intent of that third 1 week period between August 27th and September 4th, is that essentially rebuttals to the rebuttals?
In essence. And that's why I corrected Mr. Robinson is my preference. Originally was a 2 week period. New evidence, final rebuttal. In my opinion, that's what the statute requires as a minimum, okay? I've had much disagreement about that, okay, from land use lawyers to consultants to whatever. But that kept things simple, okay? One rebuttal, one new evidence period, that was it. But what's happened over time, it's evolved, is that people in your position have said, look, with all this new stuff, we want to be able to respond. Not with new evidence, just be able to respond.
And so as a accommodation is that most hearings officers now are giving this interim week for rebuttal, no new evidence, just rebuttal for anyone. In your case, I'm trying to focus on the Neighborhood Association being the entity that has that final rebuttal on your side. Now, if you hire a lawyer, the lawyer on your behalf may do so. There's, Mr. Robinson would have no objections, could have no objections to that. Okay. I didn't limit it to a person. I limited it to the Neighborhood Association.
I understand.
Okay?
Okay.
Any questions? All right. You are going to get a little piece of paper, and Mr. Robinson will be getting a piece of paper, as well as Mr. Moffitt will be getting a little piece of paper. And that piece of paper is going to have these dates on it, although it may not have finessed out everything that we wanted to. Let me take a look. Oh, it did. She's good. Clerk's better than I am. All right. So she's going to give you those pieces of paper, and those are kind of your hard copy to remind anyone of what's going on. All right. So the record will remain open, as stated. Look forward to getting information and clarification on some of the points that have been raised today. Thank you for coming. Close the hearing.